Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me again today. This is, again, a call-out. Questions that you have. We're doing a Hack the Entrepreneur mailbag episodes coming up very soon. I've got some really cool, interesting questions that I'm looking forward to asking. Are answering so far, and I would like some from you. So John at hacktheentrepreneur.com, that's J-O-N at hacktheentrepreneur.com. Any questions you have about marketing, business, software, podcasting, anything you think that I could answer? I'd love to answer it on the show. Make sure to include your name and URL of your website if you'd like me to also drop you a link in the show notes and mention it on the show. All right, let's get into it. I am your host, John Naster, but you can call me Johnny. My guest today is an author, growth hacker. In fact, he personally coined the term growth hacking back in 2010, and an entrepreneur. He got his start back in the 1990s and spent the next decade and a half heading up marketing and growth at several companies, such as LogMeIn, Eventbrite, and Dropbox. In 2012, he founded Qualaroo, a software company whose customers included Uber, Starbucks, Spotify, Burger King, and Intuit, and it was acquired in 2016. He is now the founder and CEO of GrowthHackers.com, the leading community for growth professionals with 1.8 million global users. He also just co-wrote a book called Hacking Growth, How Today's Fastest Growing Companies Drive Breakout Success. Now, let's hack. Sean Ellis. When you make a wrong hire, you feel it immediately. Your team's performance, morale, and bottom line all suffer. Whether you're screening candidates for an important position or looking for ways to improve productivity, Caliper can help. Caliper offers in-depth assessments for potential hires and current employees. Their deep knowledge and personality insights uncover key traits and behaviors, plus what motivates employees to succeed. Caliper's unique approach works with every size company and industry, from startups to the Fortune 500. In fact, their science and expertise have helped over 30,000 businesses hire, retain, and develop top talent. Caliper has an incredible offer for Hack the Entrepreneur listeners. Assess your team for free. You'll discover what makes each person tick and improve the performance of your team. They'll also give you an hour of free consulting. To find out more, visit calipercorp.com/hack. That's CalipeCorp, calipercorp.com/hack to get your free hour of consulting and get your team assessed right now. We are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very, very, very special guest, Sean. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
Absolutely my pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure. I'm glad we finally got to sit down and connect. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
I think so, too.
Nice. So let's jump into it, shall we?
Great.
Sean, as an entrepreneur, can you tell me what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
So I think for me, it's probably just ruthless prioritization down to the point where it's sort of like, what are the things that just don't matter right now? And how do I avoid spending any time on those things and really try to focus my energy behind the one or two things that I need to figure out in the business? And I think that's been really critical for me, you know, whether it's growth or fundraising or whatever it might be.
So, okay, so this is interesting. So, I mean, lots of people on this show and lots of people in general have been talking about this whole, like, one thing since the One Thing book came out. But you seem like you took it a different way. The ruthless prioritization by finding out not necessarily the one thing you have to do, but all the things that just aren't necessary for you to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you prioritize what you're going to do, you need to also prioritize what you're not going to do, because, you know, at the end of the day, you just don't have enough time to do everything. Or if you try to do everything, you're not going to do anything well.
There we go. There we go. Is there a way to determine in your head, like, what absolutely isn't necessary? Like, do you never fall into that trap of, like, everything needs to be done right now?
I do, but it's, you know, the more I stretch myself, the more that I find that, you know, it's sort of life or death if I don't figure out, if I don't figure out just the few things that really matter. So that's really critical.
Okay. So that's fine. So it's humanly impossible for you to do everything you need to do at this point. So therefore you have to prioritize and either delegate things out or leave them just be.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and that's both for me individually and then as a company trying to make sure the team's working on what really matters.
Nice. I love it. So this is your second company, I believe, now, right? Growth Hackers?
It is. It's a little bit of kind of one company. I mean, essentially we started Growth Hackers out of Kuala Lumpur, and they were both under the same company umbrella, but then we sold Kuala Lumpur as an asset sale to put more money and focus into Growth Hackers.
Oh, wow. Wow. Can you sort of take us back then in this journey? Sort of like coming from school and then working and then building a business out like Kuala Lumpur, and sort of just take us through the process that you either went through mentally, or like whether it was a conscious decision that I just need to do my own thing, or it just evolved.
Yeah. So majority of my career, I actually worked on growth at other people's companies. So yeah, I moved to Eastern Europe straight out of college, which was a little bit weird, but moved to Eastern Europe just because I was just fearing the mundane regular job that was calling my name coming out of college. And then that was in the early 90s, and ended up pretty soon afterwards investing in, and then a few months later joining an internet company. So I invested essentially everything I had into an internet company in 1995. So pretty good time to put it all on black. And you know, that company, that was sort of pre-VC money. Just a friend of mine was starting the company. And then, you know, within a week, it was already up 50% just because that was the first VC money went in. And that company's valuation peaked at about $4 billion. Was it 4 billion? Gosh, that sounds too high. It was definitely over a billion. And then, yeah, so that was, I worked on growth at that company. So basically customer zero through the NASDAQ IPO filing. And then same group of guys started Log Me In after that. So the first company was called Uproar.com. And so I was entrepreneurial, very early stage, put my money into the companies and really approached it as a you know, person who's got it all on the line when you put all your money into the company. I think that really helped me in my approach to marketing. And then Log Me In again ran Log Me In marketing from customer zero through a NASDAQ filing. Today, Log Me In's a $6 billion company. And I realized at Log Me In that the really important stage in both of these companies was figuring out the formula up front. Like, just, you know, why do customers like these products? How do we find the first few channels? How do we kind of build the processes and teams in place? And so if you don't figure that out, then there is no year two, year five in these companies. So I actually kind of took a pretty unconventional approach from there, where I went to a number of companies with an interim VP marketing type role in mind, where I'd be fully vested on stock after about 6 months and really try to position them for long-term growth. So that's how I worked with Dropbox, Eventbrite, Lookout, number of companies where we went in and tried to set everything up right from the beginning. And what's cool is that Dropbox actually just published their numbers a couple months ago, where they showed what their actual revenue growth was sort of quarter by quarter, year by year, all the way through. They just hit a $1 billion revenue run rate. And what's cool is you can see that trajectory was what we set in that first 6 months when I was with the company, and they were able to continue to do it. So that was really the goal. And so once I did that for a few years, that's when I finally kind of got bit with the bug that said, I've been growing other people's companies now for a really long time, and I wonder if I can actually do the zero to one myself in terms of creating value. And so that's, you know, in terms of like actually creating a product and trying to grow a product. And so that's what I did afterwards. And started Qualaroo. We built that over a few years and got it to millions of dollars in recurring revenue. But I saw the next shiny object, which is probably not the best way to say it, but which was Growth Hackers. But I just saw, I mean, essentially for me personally, we got Qualaroo to a cash flow positive SaaS business, which is actually pretty hard to do for SaaS business because you kind of get paid over time for the customers you acquire. And it was something where I didn't see the headroom in that business that I saw in what my vision was for Growth Hackers. So that's where I decided to sell off that as an asset sale and put it all into Growth Hackers that we've been kind of exclusively focused on for about a year now.
Wow. So you, because looking through your LinkedIn history, there's like 7 months, 8 months, 6 months, 7 months. It's like you went into companies, like set them up for growth, and then you just moved on.
Yeah, well, that was after the first two that I was.
Exactly.
I did about 5 years at each of those companies. So I'm not a perpetual company jumper.
Right. No, starting in 2008 at Dropbox, then it's just like, man, and you just like, wow, you just killed it at these places. But you got that sort of that urge, I guess, from inside somewhere that you wanted to do that whole 0-1 yourself or see,
yeah,
if you could prove to yourself, well, that you could.
Right. That, I mean, essentially, I got to the point where sort of financially, I was where I wanted to be from the equity that I'd gotten in these companies. And so at a certain, like, I think from a pure dollars perspective, doing what I was doing was kind of crazy to quit. But, you know, at a certain point, you want to see if you have it within yourself to actually conceptualize something, build it out, build the team and create something, you know, from scratch. And that's what I've been working on trying to do well up to this point.
Yeah, I love it. So with Qualaroo, this was something you wanted to build from scratch. And then you needed sort of, I guess, was it sort of like a growth engine for Qualaroo, which was Growth Hackers on the side, like a content marketing sort of engine to drive customers back to the main product?
Yeah. So what we found was, so Qualaroo, it's a little survey that pops up on websites down in the corner, kind of subtle, but asked some questions. And the whole way that product grew was there was a little powered by Qualaroo. And, you know, we tested different messages. Eventually, I think today it says, have you tried Qualaroo? But what we found is, not surprisingly, if that little survey unit ran on a marketing website, then the right audience was seeing it. You know, the people who, if they clicked on that link and converted, they would be potential customers. So contrast that, like if we ran it on Disney, and a bunch of kids clicked on that link, the likelihood of them converting into customers was really low. So we decided that there was so much great content out there around marketing and growth that if we could build a platform where we aggregated everybody else's content, built community around it, and just, you know, retained an audience on this platform, and then ran Qualaroo surveys on that platform, that would probably be easier in the long term than writing a bunch of content ourselves. You know, it's a bigger upfront investment because you have to build the platform. But once we did that, we figured that we could have a pretty good audience where we'd run our surveys and ultimately acquire lots of customers for Qualaroo. And so that was sort of the original inspiration to build out the community side of Growth Hackers.
Right. But it's fascinating because it's contrary to how everyone else would do it, which is to build their own blog and start pumping out content. So it seems like you saw thousands of other software companies and tech companies doing that. And it was just a mess of information coming at people like on an hourly basis. So you decided to somehow aggregate it and get people to like, but it's a different problem, right? It's, when you start a blog, it's just, there's kind of, it's there and you got to kind of build it. But when you start like this sort of a platform, you have to get not only people submitting, but then you have to get people reading, commenting, and sharing, yeah, from that platform.
Yeah, it's definitely much harder to get the ball rolling on a platform. But again, what I was looking at, we did do some content marketing originally, and it was actually working pretty well for us. But what I found was, every other marketing technology company was also creating content. And there's thousands of marketing technology companies who've all stumbled into the content is the way to drive distribution for our product. And so as a result, there's a massive glut of marketing content that's out there. And so for me, I was looking at that as the problem. I can just keep trying to put more content and get it noticed better than the other guys, or I can try to help solve that problem by building a curation platform. And then I also looked at a couple of unmet needs on the marketer side. One was marketers actually, I found in talking with a lot of marketers and just myself, is that most marketers, even if they're really good, operate in obscurity. They're not the CEOs that get noticed and credit in companies. A lot of them are pretty introverted. They're just working away at trying to grow businesses. And so something where they could build some reputation among their peers was a need that I saw out there. And then they also, people do look for inspiration and ideas of things to try. And so those were two things that if I could aggregate the content and build community. And one thing that we did not allow was anonymous participation. You had to link your LinkedIn to your profile on Growth Hackers. And so if you participated, it had to be with your real name. And so I think that maybe slowed growth a little bit in the beginning, but it made it a much nicer community because people weren't sort of anonymously being snarky with each other. And so, yeah, that was kind of the need that I felt like we were filling with Growth Hackers originally.
Yeah. I mean, we can go to Reddit if we want that to be yelled at and called names.
Exactly.
So what was like the initial, how did you initially sort of growth hack Growth Hackers then? I mean, I've read that you said you used like your 10,000 Twitter followers, but we all know 10,000 Twitter followers will only do so much for anyone.
Right. Well, and that was at a time when Twitter was not completely loaded with noise. So 10,000 Twitter followers was a little bit more of an asset than it is today. But I also had a couple of blog posts. I'd been blogging on startupmarketing.com for years up to that point. So, and I had a couple of blog posts that had reached about 150,000 reads. So I think I had enough sort of following in a couple of existing platforms, whether it was my blog or Twitter, where I could originally seed the community with those people, but it still was really hard. I mean, essentially it's a ghost town until it's not a ghost town. And so I had a pretty small team originally of kind of four of us working on this side project and, you know, some part-time, some full-time on this side project. But we basically kind of took turns manning the site to where if a comment went on, one of us was going to jump on and respond to that comment, have that person feel like, you know, there's vibrant activity on there. And it was 7 days a week, probably for 4 or 5 months of just long hours of just taking turns, making sure that we were engaging with anybody who wanted to engage on the site. And then by about December, January of, you know, we launched it in October, and by December, January, we got to the point where we could step out for a day and the conversation would go on, that people, you know, we'd kind of prime the pump on the community. And so it was a good breath of air because it was, we were definitely getting to the point where we were burned out. If it hadn't gotten that traction at that point, I think I'm not sure how long we could have kept that up.
Right. And you were answering as like founders or as the people behind it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think especially for me, where I had enough of a following that people were actually just kind of excited to be able to engage and interact with me around marketing content, and just, you know, kind of, it was one of those things where I think at that time I had been on clarity.fm, which is kind of a place where you can pay money to talk to somebody. And I was, you know, I'd crank my rates up so that I could focus on my business to where I think it was like $900 an hour. And I still occasionally got people to, you know, asking me questions or scheduling 15-minute calls where, you know, on growthhackers.com, they could get kind of free unlimited access to me. And so I think that helped to aggregate that original audience.
Nice. And was it more difficult to get readers of the content or more difficult to get contributors?
So the contributors was not as much of a problem because we could scour the web. And so we made sure we basically set targets, I think maybe like between 10 and 20 articles a day. We knew that the average person is only going to be able to read maybe three. I mean, there's obviously some sort of voracious readers that could just read all day, but they're not really who we were targeting. We wanted people who were actually out executing marketing and not just reading all the time. And so we figured if we could get at least 10 to up to 20 articles a day submitted on the site, then the people who were coming could vote up those articles so that two or three good ones would surface to the top. And then we'd provide value for a daily visitor. Two or three fresh, good articles that had floated to the top. So we could go out and find that content. We didn't need the community to necessarily curate that content originally. But, you know, today, now the community does all of it. But at that point, like we didn't, the supply side, we could take care of ourselves, which was very helpful.
Yeah. And there's no issue with grabbing other people's content and posting it?
It's links. So it's kind of the same way that Reddit is. So people were usually pretty stoked that we were promoting their content. And then one of the big advantages that we had pretty quickly, that Twitter following started to grow between a couple of accounts to, you know, 50,000, 100,000 Twitter followers. And at that point, essentially an article, you know, we'd have those two or three articles that would surface to the top, then they would go into our Twitter feeds. And then from the Twitter feeds, they would get shared more. And so you had this kind of perpetual traffic machine where we eventually automated a lot of kind of posting of these articles onto Twitter. But it was, yeah, I think Twitter was a really good platform to build off of. Today, it wouldn't work nearly as well. In fact, it's, you know, as a contributor of traffic, it's actually dropped for us over time just because there's so much noise on there now. But we hit it at the right time where it became a pretty good engine to get us to a good level.
Nice. I love it. So how many people are on the team of Growth Hackers at this point?
So we go back and forth. We have 10 full-time, and then we have some contractors that are sometimes full-time and sometimes off completely, depending on what we're building as a team. So originally I had the 20, and we put a SaaS product out on the business for basically cross-functional teams to work together to manage their growth. And, you know, as I was saying early on in the business, you know, this kind of ruthless prioritization, when you're trying to grow a business, the first thing that you need to prioritize toward is making sure that your product can retain customers on it so that you can actually drive growth. And we tried to grow the business for the SaaS part of our business for about 5 or 6 months and saw pretty good week over week growth of just like, you know, new customer expansion of about 10% per week to where we got it to 150 ish customers. But what we were seeing was that for this to really be effective, you needed the whole team to engage in the platform. And we were seeing our whole assumption around account expansion just wasn't happening. The accounts were often even contracting. And so that was in about January, I hit the point where I said, you know, if we keep trying to grow this thing, we're going to bankrupt ourselves. And so it's a really tough decision as a CEO to know when to pull off the gas, but I pulled off the gas, put the contract developers on ice, took my core set of developers and said they had two metrics they needed to work. One was the invite acceptance rate. So we had a pretty low invite acceptance rate of about 30-35% of invites from team members to other team members bringing them in. It was only 30-35% that were accepting them. I said, we need to double that number, and then we need to double the 30-day active after they've accepted an invite. And just having a much smaller focused team working just those numbers, my guys got there in about 5 or 6 weeks. They got to the doubling of the invite acceptance, and then they're still working on the 30-day engaged after an accepted invite. So that was basically... We have other revenue streams. So I took my operations people and put them onto these other revenue streams, but took the developers and just said, okay, let's focus on getting these core engagement metrics right before we aggressively start to scale.
Yeah. So this activation, these numbers, can you clarify exactly what those are? You said they were like 30%, 30 to 40%.
Yeah. So what I was saying is that this is a collaboration platform.
Right.
So essentially a team working together to plan and manage growth initiatives. And so it's not just marketing, but the whole idea with growth hacking is that it extends beyond marketing into product, into customer support, and across that customer journey. And what you can't really do is have a collaboration platform around something like that where only half of the responsible parties are participating in it. You know,
if, oh, I see.
Yeah. So
you're bringing it into a company, and if there's like product people, there's marketing people, there's customer service people, whoever has to be involved, if only 30% of those people are, it's ineffective.
Yeah. And so especially like we were only having 30% of the people who got invites from their teammates accepting the invite and then coming in and even trying it. And so with those sorts of numbers, I just looked and said, there's no way we're going to be able to effectively scale this business. And so that was when we basically said, okay, we're going to stop spending money and effort trying to scale the business. We're going to take the users we have on the product today and work to get the kind of unit economics right within the product, the engagement metrics right within the product, so that when we do go to scale, we can do it on a foundation that will actually support those scaling efforts. And interestingly, even without any operational effort, as soon as we got the engagement metrics better, we started to see expansion again in our monthly recurring revenue. So not at sort of VC target rates, you know, but we went from a couple of months of being flat to seeing, you know, about 10% month over month, monthly recurring revenue growth without, like, we even turned off trials for the product. And so we really tried to restrict growth, but it was just really through this account expansion. So we're seeing the right signals there. It's just a matter of trying to get all of our ducks lined up before we start to shift time and energy for the team back into the product, because we are a relatively small team at 10 people.
Yeah, really. So when you find this problem though, with like the engagement sort of metrics not being what they needed to be to scale, what, it's awesome that you figured it out, but like, what was sort of the first steps that you send that you would go on? Like, do you go right back to the beginning of the experience, or is there somewhere in the middle where that might stand out if you'd actually look at it?
No, it's really just breaking down and sort of saying, okay, you know, ultimately we need to expand monthly recurring revenue for this to be an interesting business. And basically being able to say, okay, what are the components that contribute to monthly recurring revenue? So a brand new company would be one component. And then, you know, average number of participants would be another component. Life of a participant, do they keep participating or do they stop participating? So, you know, and then even average number of participants is a function of how many invites are you sending out? How many of those invites are being accepted? So it's really kind of breaking down each of the numbers that contribute to the final metric that really matters in the business, that we're defining that matters in the business. And when we checked across all of those numbers, that's where we really saw that this invite acceptance rate was not where it needed to be. And, you know, it's actually kind of like a mini growth hackers that way, the same way that I was saying, you know, we had to work really hard to like a kind of mini community. We had to work really hard to make sure it wasn't a ghost town when a new person went in there. We have to make sure that one of these accounts is not a ghost town when one of the people goes into, you know, to start building their collaboration network inside their business for growing their business.
Nice. I like it. So this kind of takes me into this sort of almost a final question that I want to wrap up with you on, but then I do want to follow up about this new project you've just launched. So I'd like to sort of talk to you about this idea I'm working with calling the entrepreneurial gap. And this is going to be something really interesting for you, because you got started back in the early 90s. You've had some massive successes behind you and still with you right now and then in front of you. But this gap seems to be in entrepreneurs as sort of dreamers and visionaries. We're always sort of projecting our own personal successes, I find, into the future. Meaning no matter what we accomplish and from the outside, no matter how successful we look, we're always projecting our success in the future. So in 3 months when you hit that metric, in 6 months when you hit that bestseller list, whatever it happens to be, that's when you see yourself as successful. Yet you and I both know, Sean, that seconds before you get there, you're going to set 10 bigger goals into the future. So
exactly.
I would love it right now if you could just take a couple minutes to stop, turn, and look behind you. This whole journey, the highs, the lows, the wins, and the losses. But tell me how you feel about this journey up until today.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the journey is, you get kind of mixed feelings. So, you know, I'm a parent. I want to make sure that I focus on my kids and I really try to spend enough time with them. But, you know, ultimately, like if I didn't have anything else going on in my life, I would say it's the greatest journey ever. I love the roller coaster, the highs and the lows. And, you know, to me, it seems so much more interesting than going and just punching a clock 9 to 5 somewhere and, you know, not even being sure if I'm contributing that much value to the organization. So I think part of those highs and lows are, are basically, you know, in the beginning, I really rode all the way up when things look good and all the way down when things look bad. And it's a little bit unsustainable to go quite to the extreme. So what I do is a lot of checking and just saying, okay, I know things seem like they're great right now, but I need to realize that this is temporary and it's going to come back down to earth. So don't get too excited. There's a lot of work left. And when things are low, don't get too bummed out. There's, you know, there's a good day tomorrow. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of, I find it very exciting, but at the same time, sometimes a little too exciting. So you got to bring it in there. But yeah, it's hard work. And, you know, I personally couldn't imagine doing anything else. I think I would just get really bored trying to do anything else. So I do like the ups and downs, but it's, I think rarely is it less work than you expect. You know, you hear about the successes that are less work, and that's because, you know, luck is part of what we need on our side as we're launching and growing businesses. But you know, these really lucky ones are probably even kind of cleaning up the story a little bit. That, you know, I think persistence and just being really focused on the problem you're trying to solve and knowing that you're going to need to keep iterating on the solution. As long as you remain passionate about the problem, as long as I remain passionate about the problem, I know I'll be able to keep the energy to eventually get the right solution there. The minute that I stop thinking that the problem is that important, so it's a lot harder to keep grinding at it.
I love it. So with all of this, like, projects and business going on with your family, with your life going on, you decided amongst all of this to write a book.
Yeah.
A book called Hacking Growth. Why was now the right time to write this book?
Yeah, I had publishers actually approaching me for a few years about trying to write a book, and I constantly said, God, I have no time to write a book. That would be crazy. And so the difference at this time was that instead of having a publisher approach me about writing the book, I had a co-author approach me about writing a book. And he's someone who I'd co-written a lot with. So Morgan Brown, we'd done a lot of articles together. He did a lot of ghostwriting for me, which sounds kind of weird that somebody would, you know, like that I would even admit that somebody did some ghostwriting for me. But it turned out he was helping. He's one of the people helping me grow Growth Hackers originally and helped me with Qualaroo as well. And it turned out that ghostwriting was kind of the best way I could have ever mentored and trained him, because, you know, if somebody said, I'm publishing a blog post today, would you mind taking a look at it? Like, you're going to look at it kind of, you might breeze over it and say, oh, here's a couple things you might do to fix it. But when they're posting something in your name, you're going to be pretty obsessive over making sure you agree with everything that's on there. And so it was kind of cool to watch the transition where the first few times he wrote things in my name, it was almost as much discussion between the two of us to make sure that we kind of saw eye to eye on everything. You know, probably as long as it took him to write it, there was another refinement that took just as long. But by probably within a few months, we got to the point where just about anything that he put out there, I was completely in agreement with. And so when it came time to writing this book, we could conceptualize the chapters and really go through like all of the content that we thought was going to be really useful for people trying to grow businesses. But once he wrote the initial pass at things, I had very little tweaking to do. And then we had two different editors who helped us make sure that we, you know, pulled out a lot of the jargon and just that it was really clear and easy to understand. And so I don't think I ever understood what a team project, a big book is when you have multiple editors, when you have a big publisher behind it. It's I'm really proud of what we did together, but it's that I think if Morgan hadn't been really shepherding it to everything from finding our agent to the original proposals that recruited our agent to working with an agent, then going out to publishers, I definitely wouldn't have had the bandwidth to do it. So he definitely championed it through. And I think the book is something we're both really proud of.
That's awesome. I really, Sean, thought I was just kind of lobbing you an easy question and you just went and like admitted that like somebody else wrote the book.
Well, I think what you could say is that like literally four people wrote the book. Like,
yeah,
the amount of re-edits and rewrites that like the concepts that are needing to be communicated I think is the hardest part. So one of the things that I uniquely brought to the table there was that, you know, I coined the term growth hacking. A lot of the concepts behind growth hacking, I was the first to ever publish sort of observations about those. And so, you know, I think being able to kind of define a process and originate a process is only half the battle. Being able to articulate and explain it is just as important. And having a team working with me to make sure that we could do that, I think has really helped on the output of what we created.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was just bugging you with that one.
I know, I was trying not to be too defensive, but yeah.
So who is this book for and what will it do for them?
Yeah, so it's based on looking at how companies like Facebook and Uber and Airbnb have grown. And in each of these companies, what they have is a CEO who's really pushed hard, defined what success looks like in a single metric, and then aligned multiple departments in the company behind that, driving that metric. And so when you actually look at who can benefit from this book, it's really anybody in any one of those departments. So anybody who touches the customer journey from sales, marketing, product, customer success, engineering, any of those people are touching the customer experience. And then I would say first and foremost, I think probably CEOs are going to get the most out of this book because it tells them how they can effectively drive growth and start to bring together disparate parts of the organization to work together and not just kind of outsource it to marketing, but instead growth is a function of lots of touches in the business. And then any one of those individual groups, an individual from those groups, I think is going to understand a lot more about how the growth process works and what they can do to accelerate growth. So that's for a company, say, of 50 plus people. And then if you look back, as I was saying, a big part of what my focus in, you know, there was less than 10 employees when I was at Dropbox. There was probably 15 when I was at Eventbrite. Logged me in, there was only a couple of us. And so when you look at those very early stages of companies, if you know what a successful growing company looks like organizationally, you can do a lot more upfront to kind of set the right culture and expectations and not let things get too siloed too early. So even early stage companies, I think, can benefit a lot from this book.
I love it. I love it. Hacking Growth is the book. It's by Sean Ellis and Morgan Brown. You can buy it everywhere and anywhere that you buy books at this point. I will link to it in the show notes on Hack the Entrepreneur for you if you want the easy way out. I'll link to it on Amazon, but you can just go there and find it as well. Growthhackers.com is the main business right now. And at Sean Ellis, I believe, is you on Twitter, right?
That's correct.
Excellent. All right, Sean, thank you so much for taking the time to stop by. Thank you so much for sharing so openly with me. I really, truly do appreciate it. And
well, thanks, John, for having me on. This is awesome.
Yeah. Please just keep doing what you're doing, man, because it is awesome to watch.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Have you ever hired a promising applicant only to find out that their best performance was during the job interview? Whether you're screening candidates for an important position or looking for ways to improve productivity, Caliper can help. To find out more, visit calipercorp.com/hack. That's calipercorp.com/hack. All right, well, that was a lot of fun. And having Sean on the show was something that was kind of meant to be. I mean, he coined the term growth hacking. This is Hack the Entrepreneur. So it works out quite well. I'm glad I got to have the conversation, but I'm really, really excited about this part. This part of the show where I get to go back and I got to listen to the show as that third person. Right. And I got to go back and I got to look for something that Sean said that stood out to me. This is the guy that invented the term growth hacking. Now I'm going back and I'm looking for his thing that he said, that one thing. And then I found it. I missed it when I was in the conversation. I'd missed it when I went back and I listened. And then I'd missed it when I went back and listened again. But then I heard it. It was there and it was so very, very clear. Did you get it? Did you hear it? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
every other marketing technology company was also creating content. And there's thousands of marketing technology companies who've all stumbled into the content is the way to drive distribution for our product. And so as a result, there's a massive glut of marketing content that's out there. And so for me, I was looking at that as the problem. I can just keep trying to put more content and get it noticed better than the other guys, or I can try to help solve that problem by building a curation platform.
And that's the hack. Sean. I love this. I really, really love this. This is the old saying of like, when others are zigging, you should zag. Going sort of against what everyone else is doing, right? So Sean starts a company. It's a software company. So it's in technology. And the common way to growth hack or to find customers is to create content. And there's a massive glut of it. We all know this. Anyone who's around content at this point, we know that the amount of content being produced today is just astronomical compared to what we've ever seen in human history, in fact. And so rather than trying to just pump out more content into the glut, Sean, being the brilliant marketer that he is, thinks, I should do something else. Actually, what I should do is I should pick the best content that's already being created, curate it onto my site, and create community around it. It's brilliant. This is how to think, right? When everyone else is zigging, you should be zagging. When they're all zagging, you should be zigging. In any way that you can think of this, it seems like it's the easiest way is to do what everyone else is doing. If they're finding success, let's go do that. But sometimes you need just a tweak on that. It wasn't like Sean had said that content marketing does not work. He's not saying that at all. He's just saying that it's hard to make it work for my new company because everybody else is pumping out amazing content, but nobody has yet curated it. Maybe this can be done still in your market. Maybe you're not in software. Maybe your market needs curation and community built around that. I mean, there's massive sites now built around this, like Reddit and things, where Reddit's not like a particular market though. With growth hackers, this is particularly for people who are marketers, who are in like growth hacking and are like running growth on teams now. This is what they're interested in. This is can be started for any industry. I love this way of thinking. I love this way of thinking that not just that there's a glut, so we have to find something else because content doesn't work anymore, but it's like, how do we capitalize on? The problem was that there was a glut, so let's make it better for everyone and build a business around it. Sean, thank you so very, very, very much. All right. Well, that was a lot of fun. I really, really, really enjoyed that. Hacktheentrepreneur.com is the site. I'll have Sean Ellis's show notes up over there for you. I'll link out to his book for you, as well as Growth Hackers and Qualler if you want to check it out. I'll track down his social media as well. And yeah, this is the last week you're going to be able to see the original Hack the Entrepreneur that is up there now. It's getting a complete overhaul and facelift. It's looking mighty fine, I'd say. It's looking completely different. It's the exact opposite of what it is right now. Picture how it is now, and then you'll see it as the exact opposite. See, maybe you'll disagree with me. But it's live in another place right now. I'm just doing some final tweaks, and then we're going to go live to the actual domain. So if you want to check out the old site now, now's the time. All right, it's been fun. Thank you so much for stopping by. Thanks for spending this past half hour, 40 minutes with Sean and I. I really appreciate it. I'm sure Sean does as well. And please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.